The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with the Interesting People podcast. I am joined by sommelier, guest experience manager at Checkmate Artisanal Winery, one of the top wineries in British Columbia. Also, the former assistant beverage manager, one of the top people at the National Club for 3-4 years. It is James Birdie. James, thanks so much. And we're doing this from the National Club. There's an event with Checkmate with your wines, but thanks so much for doing this.
It is an absolute pleasure. I'm a huge fan of your podcast. Apologize for bringing your rating down already because it's so good. But no, it is it's a full circle moment. It's amazing to be back here. I always had the goal, as soon as I joined Checkmate, the goal was always to bring it back to the National Club. One, because I knew there's the thirst for the wines here. But two, I just fell in love with the wines while I was here. And you probably remember me serving a lot of them, promoting a lot of them. And when people would travel from around the world and they say, I want to taste a Canadian wine while I'm in Canada, Checkmate became my go-to because I found the quality just so, so high that it was always my goal to bring it back here and have that full circle moment.
Full circle works so much for this because I remember you back like in 2017 when you're starting out and then just your level of wine knowledge and how important you became with this club as the years went on. And then you and your brother making Syrah, BC Syrah, and now you being at Checkmate. So this is cool for me, but I have a lot of stuff I want to get into. I want to start here about the power of wine. You were telling me you were at an event here last night. You were amazed with the amount of people that came to talk to you. They were so excited to see you, and they would bring up, oh yeah, I remember when you opened this great bottle for us. It's one of the things about wine is wine creates events, memories, and just kind of lifts things. It makes a moment better. And so all these people remembered you, obviously because of you and who you are and your personality, but also the role the wine played as well.
I remember when I was here, Matt, that the thing I enjoyed most, and you were probably about 80% of these experiences, but what I enjoyed most while I was here was we're blessed to have an amazing cellar here, right? And when guests would come for dinner, they'd bring their family, their friends, their guests. There was always that moment where I could create that memory that lasts for a very long time. And I play a very small part in that. But if that wine can create that spark that will make that lasting memory, I think that's the coolest thing in the world. So what I enjoy the most is when that guest, that table would give you the creative license to be able to go into the cellar, find that special bottle that I found in the inventory count a week ago that I'm so passionate about, or whatever the flavor that I'm super passionate about at the time would match with the food. I love those experiences. And circling back to the National Club membership, when I would see them again a year later, 3 years later, they would remind me of those stories that sometimes I even forget about. But because it's so impactful, it sits in their brain and it creates that memory. That's what I cared about. So when I thought about moving to Checkmate, moving to a winery specifically, it had to be in an environment with an experience that created that same feeling. And that's exactly what the Checkmate experience is. It really mirrors and mimics the intimate kind of guest experience that we created here and that we foster here. And all of that is centered around the special bottle, the perfect bottle to create that memory.
And there's so many of them here at the club. I can remember 100 of them and so many great wine events, you know, with you and Brian and everyone else in the staff. So we'll get to Checkmate, which basically is a high-end Chardonnay in Merlot House. That if I did an overgeneralization one sentence, that would kind of hit it?
That would, yeah. It's when you think of the Okanagan Valley, and we'll get into it, I'm sure, but when you're down near the south like we are in Oliver and a Soyuz, those are the two grape varieties that really do thrive the best. We have the oldest vines down there. We're blessed to have these beautiful hand-farmed organic vineyards that produce incredible fruit. The two grape varieties, they really are kind of chameleons in the sense of where you have them planted. The wine will be unique based on that place. We preach the terroir thing, but there's no other projects that really embody it like we do. But those are the two varieties that really show the place like none others down in the south. When we get up to the north with our friends at Martin's Lane, they're dealing with Riesling and Pinot Noir, as you know. Those are the two that show off the slightly more northerly climate, different soils up there, a little bit more delicate, ethereal Pinot Noir and Riesling. When you're down in the south with the heat, with the soil makeup that we have, Chardonnay and Merlot just thrive.
I recently did an interview with a place called Kirby Estate, which is in Niagara on the Lake, and they were the first sort of Chardonnay Merlot house, from the Ontario area. But let's get to you. you're a young guy. How old are you right now, James?
I'm 30 years old now.
Okay. So, I mean, you've been, you know, I've known you since 2017. That is 7 years ago. So you've been doing this since you were young. I'd say probably a little bit younger than the average person when they get into wine to the level you're at. Where did this start for you? How did you first get into wine?
Yeah, it's a funny story. So my brother and I, we were working in totally different industries, different careers. I was in marketing. He was a journalist. And one of the things with us is when we get geeky about something, when we find a passion, we find an interest, we just run with it and it snowballs. So
right.
It started very early with sports. We were athletes. We listened to a guy named Matt Cause on TSN radio way back in the day. And what was interesting about Matt on the radio was not only was it marrying the world of sports, but he also talked about wine a lot. We said, this sounds pretty interesting, pretty cool. And we love food. We have a family of great cooks, and food was always a very important thing to us, European-based family. So wine was always around. The wine was always on the table, but never understood it. We went to New York on a trip with my dad in, I think it was about 2015, and we went to a restaurant. And it was Lupa Osteria in the Mario Batali circle of restaurants. And we sat down in this beautiful environment and we talked about the experience of wine. This is the place. Like, talk about romance in a restaurant. So we're sitting down and I had no real wine culture at that point, but my dad called someone over to the table and kind of waved them over. And he started describing to this person the flavors, the aromas, the texture of the wine that we really wanted to match the dishes we were having. This person ended up being a sommelier, but I had no idea what that even meant at the time. And the sommelier disappeared for 5 minutes and came back with a proudly presented bottle and described the wine to my dad. And he said, that sounds awesome. Let's try it. And he opened it, he poured it for us. And when we smelled it and tasted it, I didn't know a beverage could be this impactful or ethereal or complex as it was. And it happened to be an Italian wine, because I know that your Epiphany bottle too was Barolo, right?
Yes.
We are not too far away from that. So we were in the Langhe just next door, but it was a Barbera Nebbiolo blend from a producer named San Ferriolo. And it just knocked my socks off. It was that goosebumps moment that just sat with us. And that was the light bulb. And I said, holy hell, this can be something really serious. So that was just the spark. What happened from there was my brother and I did the WSET1 course in Toronto over the weekend. That was the basics. That just kind of created the snowball. And then WSET2, WSET3, got with the court, Master Sommeliers, and it just kept developing. I dropped the marketing thing, got into the National Club with the sommelier thing. I wanted to handle wine and taste wine frequently. My brother dropped the journalism thing, became a winemaker. So I can say it was a pretty impactful moment, because it really spurred on this whole thing. Was one from one bottle of wine in a restaurant in New York. That really created the whole thing.
It's funny. So we basically had the same origin story. You just took it further. Because I got into it.
There's still time, Matt.
Yeah, I know. Are you kidding? Making wine, that's way harder than my job. I yammer about sports. But it's funny. It's the exact same thing. And it's not just there was one Italian bottle from Northern Italy from a father figure that got you into wine. Same thing with me. The other commonality is this personality where you become almost obsessed. It's like once you get into something, everything else goes away. I always have this philosophy, if you like everything, you love nothing. So then I get the goosebumps, same thing as you. And then it's like, okay, I need to learn all about this. And you had that with your brother. That's also cool that this journey, though been different, this has been a journey for you about you and your brother as well.
It has. And like I said, when we get into things anyway, we as a family unit, we just pursue it with that slightly obsessed level. I think can be healthy or unhealthy, but there is a genuine thirst to gain and gain knowledge, which I've always been someone with the certifications, with the courses, with all of that. I just love, like you with a diploma, I just love that drive to keep learning and find out, especially if it's wine, where did that flavor come from? How did we derive that texture of the wine? Let's learn about the soil. Let's learn about the geology. That just all kind of perpetuates. The thing with my brother is, you know, him being a winemaker, the real development of my knowledge, which was really happening while we knew each other at the club, was I would go over there and help him with harvest. So even if it was for a few days or a week or 2 weeks,
you're getting your hands in the dirt. You're exactly real world learning.
Yeah. So those wines from those vintages suck because I had a big impact on them. but no, it like being there and physically handling the fruit when it comes in, and you're weighing the bins and then you're processing it and you're using a destemmer and a crusher and a press, and you're cleaning the press. He makes you get right up inside there and you have to clean it out, and you're filthy, you're sticky, and they're 16-hour days. But what you learn in that process is how wine is actually made. And that has a huge impact when you then come back to serve you a bottle on the table and the guest says, I like this flavor, I like this texture, I like this aroma. What happens in your brain is you have a little Rolodex of all these techniques and this process to say, oh, I know how we derive that. I know classic regions that have that. I know classic wines that have that exact thing. So it really adds a ton of context. Then I get to the point where I actually make my own wine a couple years later, one barrel, a little bit of Chardonnay, and watching that process from start to finish is hilarious because, again, when you're ultimately responsible for it in the end and you're trying to do a wild fermentation, you're letting malolactic happen naturally, you're not filtering, you're not fining, you have to take certain steps or ignore certain steps to make that wine. And what it does is it just keeps adding context and context. So it's one thing to be a sommelier, work with a great cellar, read the books, have the knowledge, but when you actually get your hands dirty doing the thing, it changes everything. So being able to do that with my brother at the winery, and you can imagine conversation at the dinner table or phone calls with him, is just first thing on the tip of our tongue, wine.
Oh, that'd be great. That would be great. And yeah, it also, context is the right word. It also makes you, either as a sommelier or the job you're doing with Checkmate, it makes you a much better storyteller because you can tell the whole story of the wine, every element of it, in a much more personal way, because you know you've been a part of it. All right, we're gonna bounce around. Well, let's talk a little bit about Checkmate, but let's go specifically. What do we have in our glass? And I don't feel it's a Chardonnay, but tell the listeners, what are we drinking?
Yeah, so it's a rare wine. Let's put it that way. This has become kind of a cult following for Checkmate. It's very celebrated. It's become pretty much internationally known now, which is kind of a rare thing for Okanagan wine specifically. But this is a wine called Little Pond. We're a house that only makes Chardonnay and Merlot, right? But we make 7 different Chardonnay every vintage and yep. 4 different Merlot. So it's kind of a unique project just starting with that. What we love to do is tell single vineyard stories, and all of our vineyard sources are from about 20 minutes around the winery. So it's very Southern Okanagan focused. But this is a vineyard that, you know, it was the first Checkmate wine that we ever made. And when you think of the Little Pond, the pond can be maybe an insignificant, or you think it might be an insignificant move when you're starting a game of chess. But starting our project, this became a very big deal. So in 2015, this was actually the first, Canada's first 100-point scoring wine in the eyes of John Schreiner, wine critic. And every year since then, Checkmate has received a 100-point score. So now we're at 7. So first instance of 2015, we're tasting the latest 100-point scoring wine, Little Pond 2020. As you can imagine, with a 100-point scoring wine, they disappear pretty quick.
Yes.
So when they're released, give it a month or two, everyone's calling about it. Everyone wants to buy it. So we do control it for our wine club membership. Once that allocation period is done, whatever's at the winery, whatever's left, is up for me to do whatever I want. So we have about 48 bottles of this wine remaining. I brought a case with me here to Toronto. So you're probably the last person to taste this wine because it's going to be gone in a few hours, I'm sure.
Yep.
Once we get upstairs and do our event. But moral of the story, whether or not you agree with point scores or critics, for me, it can often be one of our most complex Chardonnays. It has a length kind of unlike any others. I challenge you to sit with this, have a sip of it, and in 3-5 minutes, you're still going to be tasting this wine. It's from a stunning vineyard on the Black Sage Bench, also on the east side of the valley down where we are. And when you're standing in this vineyard, you're surrounded by mountain. It's completely silent. You're on these incredibly sandy soils. The last time I drove over there was actually wild horses that run around that whole vineyard. I couldn't that stop my car because I had to cross the road and they were in the way. So it sounds cheesy, but there's this kind of serene, there's just a magic quality to the vineyard itself. But then you actually make the wine from these beautiful old vines. There's a density, a concentration, and a complexity that's just not often found with Southern Okanagan Chardonnay. And I think that is why it has consistently been this 100-point scoring, super well-received wine in the portfolio. And it's one of 7 Chardonnays. Like, we're blessed to have consistently, you know, between 92 to 100-point scores from many publications, not just one critic. But this one consistently, it just checks the boxes for many people's palates, and it just has a little bit of everything that people love. So it's become the cult favorite.
I got a question about this wine, but going to my research about Checkmate, early on winning the International Wine and Spirit Competition in London for top Chardonnay in the world. I think that was around 94. And by the way, When it comes to awards or 100 points, I get the cynicism, and there should be cynicism. But I think especially for newer areas, the awards and the points matter because people's wine buying habits and drinking habits are very conservative. Sometimes if you want to get people to leave their normal old world ways, the scores mean more because it creates this legitimacy and it almost normalizes people trying wines that aren't in France, Spain, or Italy.
I agree with you. And when you think back to the International Wine and Spirit Competition, in 94, the rest of the world couldn't even pronounce the Okanagan Valley.
Yeah.
Right? So they didn't know we can grow grapes, make wine, or make fine wine. Whether or not you agree with that system, what it was a blind tasting. So there's no prejudice in terms of what you're tasting. It's up there with the best of Burgundy in California. Everyone makes Chardonnay. And when you're doing it blind, you're just purely evaluating what's in the glass. And they did the blind tasting, and it was from the Queen Taken Vineyard, called the Clava Vineyard, now named after the family that was farming it. And when they tasted it, they selected this as best Chardonnay in the world because it had amazing characteristics, a unique characteristic in the world of wine. It was these, I know you love this term, Burgundian techniques. But when you mix that with this new world signature of a very unique fruit that it really you can't find anywhere else in the world, the Okanagan is unique in that way in terms of the fruit that you get from it. When they tasted that, they said, this is truly, truly beautiful. They selected that wine as best Chardonnay in the world, won the Avery Trophy. They thought it was like a paperwork error, like an admin error. So they actually retested it and they got the same wine.
Wow. So second, it wasn't just a one-time emotion,
this
brief moment.
Twice.
Right.
So it was a very big deal. And
that is a big deal.
If you were there in the 90s in the Okanagan, you would have driven around, you would have seen a lot of orchards. There were some vines, a lot of orchard land. What you saw after that moment was a real development and investment into the wine industry in the Okanagan. So when you're there now and you're standing on the beautiful veranda at Checkmate and you look out, it's a ton of beautiful vineyard land. We still have that orchard industry and the apple and the cherries and everything, which is beautiful. But what it did was spur a lot of investment into great vineyard land, developing vineyard land, a lot of investment into wineries. And we actually created this amazing industry. And a lot of that was born from this truly amazing thing. When you think of the Judgment of Paris, the bottle shock thing.
It's the exact same thing, just in a different location.
It's that on a slightly smaller scale, different location. But what it did was it really, that was the catalyst. That was the spark that really kicked off this thing. And now you drive to the Okanagan, you have all different types of wineries, all different types of experience, different grape varieties, different price points. There is now this a little bit of everything, which is great for an industry. If you look at California, if you look at Australia, if you look at everywhere, you have that. You have the independently owned places, the mom pop shops. You have the more commercial volume, the wines that you're going to see all around the world. We have a little bit of everything now, which is really important for an industry. Where my interest really falls are the very focused projects like Checkmate, where we're trying to make wines to compete with the 1% of the world. I know everybody says it, but we really are. That's been the goal from the start. What's important about the region is we have all of that now. And a lot of that was really kickstarted by the International Wine and Spirit Competition.
I remember being at the top of the TD Tower here in downtown Toronto at a wine event, and it was blind and it was all Chardonnay. And it was mostly French, and it was Montrachets and Meursaults and things like that. And one of the top, one of the favorite wines. This wasn't like a, you know, an official competition. This was more of a wine professionals media thing. And Checkmate was one of the top wines. Like, and it was right next to a bunch of Meursaults and things like that. And people picked it out. And people were like, that's the best wine. It's like, oh, that's from Checkmate. And I think those stories are important. Okay, getting back to this wine, I'm just going to take a blind guess here. I don't think there's a lot of new oak on this, and there's a lot of body, and the finish is there. And sometimes when I think Chardonnay, and then I think body and big and power in the mid palate and long finish, I'm like, oh, okay, this must have a lot of new French oak. I don't sense it, which either means it's really well integrated. I just want to know a little bit, just geek out for a second, the vinification of this wine.
The interesting thing with our portfolio, and I don't know many other wineries like this, is we make 5 single vineyard Chardonnays, and they're all vinified essentially in the exact same way. So not only is the grape variety the same, but the aging, the fermentation, the vessels, they're consistent between. So when you stack them all up beside each other, you're getting a true imprint of the terroir. So all the variables are very consistent.
Okay.
And then you're just left with the pure character of the vineyard, which is really interesting. So the winemaking for the single vineyards is we ferment in barrel. Around half of the barrel is brand new French oak. Half is used.
Mm-hmm.
So it's direct split right down the middle. So you're getting a lot of character from that new French oak, but the other half you're getting mostly texture, basically. But we keep that the same between all of them. We spend 16 months in the barrel, full malolactic on everything, lots of solids, lots of stirring of the lees. We like that richness and that character. We don't filter our wines. It's totally organic in the vineyard, in the cellar, 16 months of aging, and then we release them 3 years from the harvest date. So that's kind of the protocol.
So what I appreciate with this is sometimes richness in Chardonnay, you can taste the work. You could taste, oh, you can tell they've gussied this up. I can't tell with this at all. Like my first thought would be, you know, well-made Premier Cru Chablis. That would kind of be the first place that I would go to with this wine.
Yeah. What I think what separates us a little bit is truly we're blessed to have the best Chardonnay vineyards in the Okanagan period. And what it is are mature vines that are in a great spot between, you know, 30 years to now 50 years of vine age. It's a density thing. It's a crop load level. These right. vineyards produce almost nothing compared to, you know, young, exuberant, youthful vineyards. We're dealing with, you know, less than a ton per acre up to like 2 tons per acre when it comes to yields. So
stop you there. Please. So I always like to put in context. So that's 1 to 2 tons per acre. Mm-hmm. What does that compare to say, famous white wine regions in Burgundy?
Yeah, we're playing in that range. We really are. Like, there's a direct correlation between yields and concentration, and a lot of people say quality of the fruit. So when you have a young vineyard that's, let's say, 4 or 5 years old, they're exuberant. They got a lot of energy. They want to grow a lot of fruit. That doesn't necessarily translate to quality of fruit. It can be a little bit, if you think of it, it's watered down in a sense. It's a lot of fruit, but there's not a ton going on there. When you're dealing with naturally low yielding vineyards, you get so much concentration. And I think you're talking about density of the wine. How I think you get that, sure, you can get that with wood, you can get that with winemaking technique.
Yeah.
But you almost can't mimic that low yielding concentration of just a beautiful old vineyard doing its thing naturally. And that's what we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, I have no problem with oak. I always hate people, oh, I hate oak in my wine. No, you don't. You like oak in your wine. You just don't like when oak is done incorrectly in the wine. It's bullshit. It's the easiest thing people do. But no, that's a great Chardonnay. And as you know, whenever you do the debate, you know, your favorite grape, Chardonnay has to be in the top four. It's such a hard one.
It is. And I think a lot of people, I'm sure we'll get to this because we picked two pretty controversial grape varieties with Chardonnay and Merlot, but people will come into the winery and it's the ABC right. thing. Yeah. And then they're like, I can't stand Chardonnay. And I'm fully confident I'm going to find a wine in our portfolio that they will like, because even though they're made the same, they're aged the same, everything's consistent and it's all Chardonnay. The styles vary so much one to the next. There's unique flavor, aroma, texture to each of them. And that's just a terroir signature. And they'll leave our winery saying, holy shit, I like Chardonnay. And we're like, yeah, you like Chardonnay.
Yeah, of course you do. Almost everyone does. That by the way, that must be a nice feeling. That must be a nice feeling.
It is.
Feeling.
We take great pride in converting people because, I mean, you're the same as me. Like, they're the wines of the old world I probably love the most. You know, mm-hmm. when you can actually taste the beauty of working here was getting the chance to open some well-aged Burgundy, white Burgundy specifically. And I just fell in love with that style of wine. So when you can kind of mimic that on our own back door, it's a pretty cool thing. And it is unique, but there's nods to the old world. You get that Chablis signature, you get that Meursault signature sometimes in a unique expression from the Okanagan, which is the coolest thing.
By the way, we're running out, but there's still some good value old white Burgundy at the club. I've demoed all the Rieslings here. I've been demoing the Ontarios and the old white Burgundies. That's kind of where
I still know where the good ones are hidden. I'm not sure if Jeremy does, so we won't tell him, okay. But give me an hour after this to go find some.
Oh my God. I want to get back to you and your first years here, but before we do that, because you mentioned the two most controversial grapes, have to ask this question, how dumb is the movie Sideways, even though it's also a wonderful movie?
It was a good movie. There was there's a massive reaction to Merlot after that movie that I don't know if we ever fully recovered from that. So when you look at a winery with Chardonnay that had this ABC movement, then we have Merlot that was just completely, you look at like vineyard land of Merlot after that movie, plantings were pulled up, like the industry of the price per ton, all of that stuff just tanked. And there's some beautiful Merlot out there. what we found was people still talk about it, but the difference is when, even if you pour it for them blind, because my first Checkmate wine was poured blind for me, and I did not think it was Merlot, and I did not think it was Canadian. I thought it was Right Bank Bordeaux. I thought it was Sentimillon. I thought it was Pomerol. It just had that richness and density of fruit, but all a lot of earthy tertiary stuff going on. It can be a very complex grape when you allow it to be and you have the techniques to do so. So when we pour for people, I think Merlot has this thing of you're going to taste a lot of rich, ripe fruit. There's going to be pretty much lacking acidity and no tannin, and it's going to be one note, one thing. But Matt, you'll taste it tonight, and I think you did last night. With our Merlot, it's like there's texture, there's acidity, there's a lot of fruit, but there's a lot of other things going on. There's spice, there's earthiness, there's... I remember when I was a kid, I used to open the spice cupboard a lot at my grandma's house, and you'd get this waft of like clove and anise and all these woodsy spices she would use in her cooking and her baking. And I always think of that when I pick up like a Black Rook Merlot from Checkmate. There's always this density, there's spice, there's dark fruit, but there's a whole lot of stuff going on. It's not just one note. So again, taking great pride in converting people back to the Merlot train, because it's going to take a lot of work to get people there.
The crazy thing is Sideways wasn't like some... a Marvel Avengers movie where it was like $2 billion. Like, it was an independent film, and yet this independent film with this one line delivered expertly by Paul Giamatti changed everything. It really does scream to just how insecure the wine buying public can be, and just how volatile, how one line in an arty movie can change so much. It's crazy.
It is crazy. And what was it? It was a Cheval Blanc or something that he tasted at the end of
it. Yeah, which is Right Bank Bordeaux.
Which predominantly had a lot of Merlot in it, which is kind of funny. So
I've looked it up. I think that bottle had like over 60% Merlot in it.
See, there you go. It's not all that bad.
Yeah.
It's true though. And it's convincing a lot of people that not only Merlot on the whole, but Merlot from the Okanagan Valley, like showing people that style has been really fun. And there's other great, beautiful grape varieties down there. There's Cab Franc, there's Syrah, there's Cabernet Sauvignon. There's a lot of rich, hearty, complex reds down there. But what we found with our vineyards is we almost creep into that grape variety territory sometimes with our Merlot. Like, people will pick up our glass and say, this is Syrah or Cab Franc. Like, no, it's Merlot.
Yeah.
It's very complex, and it is an expression of the place. And that's the Right Bank Bordeaux mentality, is they're telling the story of the place, and Chardonnay and Merlot do that, but on our own back door.
What was your first year like here at the National Club back in 17?
It was wild, man. It was an introduction to a world that I kind of didn't know existed. The private club mentality is, and the environment is, a beautiful thing. There's nods to the kind of the antiquated side, but there's this investment and development into the modern new side that you've seen happen over the years, which is really cool. The beautiful thing about it is the relationships that we see the same members consistently, and kind of like we have, like, you start to dial into their likes, their needs, their wants, and it really develops a great relationship. So I thoroughly enjoyed that. Learning the ropes of the world was really fun. Yeah, you get exposed to this mentality of, you know, with this clientele, they want the best of the best, and they want the best consistently. And when you have a 40,000 bottle wine cellar with Grand Cru Bordeaux, Grand Cru Burgundy, aged, beautiful aged California, great growths, wines from around the world, they're not going to blink at a $700,000, $2,000 bottle. And you got to get comfortable with that. Because I remember my first week of working here, a bottle of DRC was ordered, Latoche 1999. It was the last one we had.
Oh.
And I had the honor to serve it.
Did you have to take the cork? Were you cork out and everything?
With shaking hands. Oh. So I served a table side. And as you can imagine, however old I was, 21 or something, pouring at table side, I was just shaking. I was like, this is the Holy Grail. Like, yeah. I've only read about this in books. And what I heard from people that tasted it, this is it. This is Pinot Noir. This is the Holy Grail of it. So I was nervous. But when you look at the guests and you look at the table, your job is to create the most amazing experience for the guests with good hospitality, great service. And the shaking hand wasn't a part of that. But that was my first week. So that was, this is your new world, James, kind of thing. And that was 5 days a week, Monday to Friday, you know, and it could be a Tuesday night. It could be up on 1874 restaurant. And if someone's in the mood for Lafitte 88, you're going to serve Lafitte 88, you know? So that was the main education. That was exposing me to this incredible environment where there's a proper wine culture here, people love this world where, you know, a kid from North Bay, Ontario wasn't necessarily exposed to that growing up. So it was a lot at the start, but once you get comfortable with it, you get excited by the prospect of working with four sellers in the basement of 40,000 bottles. And then when Matt Cause comes in, you can get to have a lot of fun and find the right bottle for him.
I always like to play. I always like to play.
Which we appreciate.
Yeah.
Right? We love people that are like, here's my budget.
Yeah.
100, 200 bucks. What are you excited about? I'm having this for dinner. Go play.
Yeah.
And that's fun.
Oh, yeah. I'm the guy that's like, wait, you have a Waiheke Island Merlot. Let's, yeah, I remember. Oh, and it was done. Yeah.
Cooking wine.
Yeah. God, that's high-end cooking wine. By the way, shout out to Waiheke Island. Great Bordeaux blends in that area. But now we're just going to get really too geeky. That's even almost a little too wine hipster even for me.
And that's a statement.
What were the early days? You sort of talked about it, but with Checkmate, what attracted you? Obviously, you must have known a lot about it because your brother, you made wine. So, you have a lot of knowledge about Okanagan wines. What was it about Checkmate?
Well, how it kind of started was the original winemaker of Checkmate, who really started the whole thing off, Phil McGann, traveled to Checkmate, just one of his in-market trips back in 2016, I think it was. And that was some of the early days of me tasting Checkmate, but got to meet and chat with Phil, work with him on a couple wine tastings and dinners, and just learned a lot about the project. And as I said, we had every single Checkmate SKU in the cellar here when I first joined. I think we bought the entire Ontario allotment for the first few years. So you look at a lot, we still have some 2013s, 2014s floating around in the cellar here. That was from that early purchasing. So had that early introduction where I just really fell in love with the whole concept, the winemaking, the farming, the whole story with Phil. Traveled there for the first time in 2018 to the Okanagan to visit Checkmate. I went with my brother, and that was kind of one of those, again, epiphanies where just like, we have this geography in Canada. Like, have you been to the Okanagan before?
Oh yeah, I've been to the Okanagan, yeah. But I haven't been down, because actually, why don't you explain a little bit just about where you guys are specifically located?
Yeah, so if you're in Kelowna, which is kind of the big city around there, if you drive south from Kelowna about an hour and a half, 2 hours, you start to get closer and closer to the U.S. border. We are right there by the U.S. border. So in a town called Oliver and a Soyuz, they're about 20 minutes from the U.S. border. So we're well south. And when you get down there, it's like desert. It really is. It's sandy. It's hot. It's dry. And seeing that for the first time in 2018, I was like, I can't believe this is in Canada. You know, when I moved there in 2021, I moved there. It was 48 degrees for about a week. It was bone dry. I didn't see rain the entire time. It's an extreme place. And the geography is mountainous, and there's valleys, and there's beautiful lakes. It's a crazy place, and it's a landscape that it might be harsh when you first meet it, but once you spend some time there, you fall in love with it. It just grows on you. So that was the experience in 2018 on the first visit, was that. And I thought to myself at that time, because I visited my brother's winery, and, you know, do the winemaking thing in bite-sized pieces, I was like, it would be so cool to be at a winery, looking at vines every single day, seeing fruit, tasting fruit when it comes in from the vineyard, watching the fermentation process. I always had that dream to be right there sharing a wall with it. So when I was here at the National Club, I would do these trips and these stints in BC where I just fall in love with the place, come back here and serve the wines. And I was like, you know what? I think it'd be so cool to do this one day, be the ambassador for a winery. I always had that vision. The opportunity kind of presented itself where I got to a point where I was like, you know what? Done the Ontario thing for a long time. Downtown Toronto was awesome. Learned a ton here. Working with National Club was so much fun. I was like, I kind of wanted, this is the time of life where I was like, I want to make a jump, you know, and it's a big jump across the other side of the country. To do that, I needed the right opportunity. I needed the right winery. I needed the right place. And my first email, my first inquiry about what's going on the West Coast was to Checkmate. And luckily, we're in the thick of a 7-year construction project at the time, building the incredible winery where we are now. It's stunning. And that was just finishing. And there was a need for leadership there to create the experiences and really define what the Checkmate on-site experience is like. And it was just perfect timing. So we moved there in June of 2021. And it was a crazy vintage to move there to grow grapes and make wine. But again, once I got comfortable, the place grows on you. And it's just been the most wild adventure and so much fun since then.
That must have been such a bit of a culture shock, coming from downtown Toronto to small town desert British Columbia. That had to be a bit of a shift.
It's the total opposite, you know, and it's so much fun to come back because you just, like, you know, everything's changed around here, but it's all still the same, if that makes sense. It just, you still get that battery charge and that energy when you're downtown Toronto. And then when you go back to Sleepy Oliver in the Okanagan agriculture country, there's just this kind of thaw out. You feel this relaxation because it's all vineyard land.
Yeah.
It's mountains, it's lakes, and there's just total flip-flop philosophy. Growing up in Northern Ontario, slightly more rural, you know, it's very much Muskoka kind of vibe.
Yep.
Lucky enough to grow up on a beautiful lake there. So the slightly more rural feel for me is very comfortable. Small town vibe is very comfortable, but I know Chelsea was probably listening to this. She loved the downtown Toronto life, and it was an adjustment for her to go to the slightly quieter place. Well, like the
good for her for also supporting you and to also having to make that adjustment. You know, yeah, that's
huge change.
Yeah,
but I thank the decision every day because it's mm-hmm. been one to get closer to the brother, and the winemaking has been so cool. He now has two very young sons. To be close to the nephews is great, but to be that close to the wine industry directly on my back door is a lot of fun.
Also, if anyone is complaining about living in a small town and then coming to Toronto, I would recommend get into a car at the lakeshore and drive, see how long it takes you to drive 1 kilometer north on Bay Street. That will take you 30.
Change your mind pretty quick.
Jesus Christ. Like when I'm driving around the vineyards, you know, in Grimsby and Lincoln and, you know, in Niagara, and then I'm anywhere near here, completely different. Speaking of vintages, how much, and another reason why I wanted to get you on, I want to talk to a couple people in BC and Okanagan about this. The winter of 2024, early to mid-January, minus 27 degrees in part of the Okanagan. First, how much did it impact you guys because you're in a warmer climate?
Huge. Yeah, if anyone tells you any differently, frankly, they're lying. It's catastrophic. We're coming off 2023, which was approximately a 50% reduction of yield from a similar thing. But this year is, I mean, I haven't seen it in the world of wine. It's unlike what many people have seen in the world of wine. And we're blessed to have a lot of talent from around the world when it comes to viticulture and enology. And I'm hearing from people that are like, we've never seen this before. And you're right. It was that minus 27, minus 28 period. I think it was for 36 hours.
That's all it took.
I think his first week in January was what really did the damage. And we had a beautiful winter right up until then. It was lovely. It was mild. It was great. And then we just got Hell Week out of nowhere. The interesting thing about it is this year we've made the decision. We're not going to take a single grape in this year, even if there is a single grape out there. What we're going to do, like we've always been a winery that's looking 3, 5, 10, 20 years down the road, like a game of chess. There's not nothing immediate. We're planning many, many moves in the future. What we're going to do is we're gonna farm them just like we normally would. So we're going to invest a lot of labor into treating these vineyards to try and get them back to a good state. So we're looking at changing the pruning, changing techniques, thinking about hilling up, burying the vines. So when we see a cold event coming up again, we can protect them. And it's a lot of labor. It's a lot of investment into that. But you can save an entire vintage of fruit by doing these things. And we want to create a stronger root system, a stronger vine for not just the next vintage, but every single one after that. It's a huge hit this year. We're blessed that, you know, we release 3 years or 4 years from the harvest date. So we kind of, if we need to be a little bit more strategic with releases, pushing forward, pulling
you
back.
You can bring in money.
We're a little bit different that way.
Yeah.
Many wineries in the Okanagan, you know, they make wine to release it the next year. They need that cash flow. They need that influx. It's very tough if you have estate vineyards that, you know, might have just been reaching maturity. And it's not just growth for the next year that might be dead. It's vine mortality. It could be vines completely killed off. And you know what the replant process is like for a vineyard, you know.
That's 4 years.
At a minimum. Yeah. And you look at a project like Checkmate, like we're not going to use a young vine until it might be 10, 15 years old, right? Because we're talking about density and quality of fruit again. As they start to get older to a point, they're going to get better and better and just kind of naturally reduce their yields. So in a very focused premium farming and winery project like ours, you got to be looking 15, 20 years down the road for your vineyard. So something like this can be catastrophic to the industry.
You're not releasing a 2000. There will be no Checkmate in 2024 or 23 vintage. Excuse me.
You're not going to see an Okanagan. You're going to be hard pressed to see an Okanagan wine period in 2024.
I mean, that's crazy. you know, that's crazy for the young places, the startups, as you mentioned. What was January 14th like living in where you are, living in Vernon, living in Kelowna?
Being a Northern Ontario boy, I felt very comfortable.
Yeah.
Because I was like, this feels like home.
Yeah.
One of the beautiful things about living out there is you do have mild winters, right? You do get a little bit of snow. There's an incredible ski industry out there. When you look at Big White, Mount Baldy, Apex, beautiful mountains to ski out there. The interesting thing was it was a really tough year for the ski industry out there too, because the conditions weren't great. It was such a mild winter.
Jesus.
So not only was it a mild winter, not great snow,
right,
then we had this crazy freeze event. So it was beautiful right up until that point, but then you just saw it coming and you just sensed this heaviness on the industry. I remember Spencer Kelly, our winemaker, coming into my tasting room. He's just dialed into his phone. I said, "What's going on, Spence?" And he was looking, and it was a few days out from that. And you could just feel this weight that we saw coming. And there's just not a ton you could have done about it if you weren't set up to hill up and do that kind of thing.
And hill up means to just bury all
the... Literally put soil on over the trunk of the vine.
Yeah.
Like you see it a lot in Prince Edward County and in Ontario and Niagara. It happens a lot in Washington, you know, in these kind of continental places that might really, really peak and dip when it comes to summer and winter. Not a ton of that set up in the Okanagan, but it's going to be a thing that's set up in the Okanagan from now on. I guarantee it. So we saw it coming. Spencer felt it. And all of a sudden it just hit. And there was that kind of peak, that 36 hours that really did the damage. But it kind of led up to that for a whole week. And, you know, painful to walk the dog at night. You know, mm-hmm. You walk outside and just it had that wind chill, extreme winds, very, very cold. And you could just, you look at the window at Checkmate to the Vines and you just... It sounds silly to feel bad for a plant that's sticking out of the ground, but you just felt it. You know, you wanted to go out there and protect them as best you could. And that was what did it. That was the damage.
So will some wineries, what I've been reading about, that maybe don't have what you guys are doing, where you don't release for 3 years, so then you can change things to bring in cash flow. Will we see other wineries taking grapes or juice from Ontario, Washington, California, label it correctly? Hey, this is our vineyard. But these are grapes we've sourced from somewhere else. Like, is that going to happen?
I think you will. There's a huge debate going on about that. I think with what's been happening for the past 20 years is like Canadian wine industry is fighting for a sense of place and they're fighting for an identity. So a lot of wineries will want to just make Canadian wine. They don't want this international blend
right. Kind
of concept.
So yeah.
You're going to see that with a lot of people. But when you look at the alternative to that argument, and there is an argument for both sides that to sustain an industry, to lose basically two vintages of wine and fruit, it can be very, very bad, and it's going to be a huge economic hit. And if you're going to lose wineries because of that, that's not necessarily positive for the industry either.
Yeah.
So I think you're going to see both. You're going to see some imported stuff. What I'm very interested in is not just importing bulk juice or grapes or fruit or wine, sorry. What I'm interested in is like going out and sourcing like a great California vineyard or Shea Vineyard Pinot Noir or something, you know. Oregon is very exciting. Washington is very exciting. Ontario is very exciting. Not just producing a lot of stuff to produce a lot of stuff, but like actually giving a great signature of that amazing fruit elsewhere, but doing it on home soil,
mm-hmm.
doing a one-off bottling of this is Hudson Valley Chardonnay from California, but done here with our techniques.
Right.
That's something that, you know, there's been a lot of polling, a lot of research into clients and guests of wineries saying, would you be interested in this? Would you taste this? Would you buy this? And the reception's been very positive for that concept of making great growths in our own wineries around the world. When it comes to the bulk juice or wine or grapes, probably a different conversation, but that's more of a just sustain technique, whereas there's something kind of exciting about making Hudson or Hyde Valley or Vineyard Chardonnay up here, because it's just incredible fruit that people like seek out anyway. It's a bit of a different mentality. So I'm intrigued by both. I see the arguments for both sides, but the precedent's kind of been set with Ontario. I can't remember the vintage when something similar happened before.
I think it was Prince Edward County. I think it was 16.
Okay.
Where they had and it was either 15 or 16. I think it was 16, where they had a frost during like May 2-4 weekend, where it's the same thing, where 70, 80, 90% loss of production for a lot of those places. I remember talking to Grange, and they were telling me that story as well. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's been done around here. So I think certain wineries will have to do that to sustain, and we want them to sustain because, as I started this whole thing out with, it's important to have many types of wineries, many concepts, many different types of ownership and price points and types of wine. I think it's very important for a region. So if we start to lose that,
yeah,
it becomes a bit of a problem.
Yeah, you need your Tuesday Okanagan wine, and then you need your birthday Checkmate Chardonnay. You need to have all those ranges because, you know, again, you need that sort of diversity. Oh, that's good. By the way, I haven't even asked. Explain to people what it means. I mean, A, you must be the best guest experience manager out there because you've experienced every part of wine on the sales, on the making. Your main jobs, your role at Checkmate?
I love the idea of taking these wines and showing them around the world. I really do, because it all comes back to the sommelier thing of, I loved getting geeky about a bottle, finding out all the details about it, tasting it, and then being able to introduce it to people. It's the same with Checkmate, but knowing it on a more, even more intimate level. So I really enjoy the idea of introducing these wines to someone who hasn't tasted them in the States, mm-hmm. or over in England, where we now have distribution and we're placed in a Michelin star restaurant. There's never been a more exciting time for this winery. It's not an escalator of momentum, it's an elevator. It's crazy that the recognition we're getting, the desire for these wines around the world now is insane. And I think a lot of that has just been born from the early accolades and the success of it. But with that success and recognition has also come a development of wine quality. And now with Spencer Kelly on board, if you think the wines are pretty good already, and if you think they're at 10, he's going to take them up to 11 or 20. He's incredibly talented, so knowledgeable, and he's just so dialed in as a BC native who's worked abroad for a long time, or worked in the States for a long time, more specifically. He's brought back so much knowledge, and he's just going to take this project to the moon. He really is. So it's the idea of being able to be a champion for the winery and ambassador to spread the good word that really, really excites me.
What do you think is a harder challenge? Because you mentioned about traveling around, and you said California, and you said London, England. So let's use those two. What do you think is tougher, to convince a 48-year-old man, a 48-year-old Californian to drink Checkmate Merlot versus Napa Cab? The other one, a 48-year-old British fella, to say, put down that Merceau and pick up this, you know, this little pawn. Which one do you think is, which one do you think is tougher to sway?
I mean, there's an answer to that, and I'll come to it. I think, frankly, there's a learning curve with both, because one, most people can't pronounce the Okanagan, they've never heard of it. So it is truly a new thing for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
I think if you're looking at kind of the palate of both of those places and those people, Napa, California as a whole is more dialed into the style of our Merlot specifically than maybe the old world is. I think it's an easy introduction to someone that loves Napa Cab,
right,
Australian Shiraz, that kind of rich, full-bodied style. Easier introduction for the California palate. I think the difference for the California palate is where you might get California Merlot that kind of follows that typical Merlot kind of structure. Rich fruit, a little bit less acidity, a little bit less structure. When you taste our Merlot, it has the opposite. Tons of structure, lots of acidity, lots of freshness. So they might even enjoy that style better than what they might have on their back step. It can often be more complex than many of the examples I've tasted over there. In the old world, what they're really jiving on are the shards. They're finding similarities to wines that are starting to get priced out a little bit. So the Premier Cruz, the Grand Cruz of Burgundy. So they're starting to see similarities at a slightly lower price point. We're still premium, mm-hmm. and that price is a direct reflect of our process.
Yeah.
It's still a premium price point, but it's still approachable in the sense of you can have that wine on the restaurant list. You can actually pour it for people. But it has all the best things that they are seeing in the Village, the Premier Cru, sometimes the Grand Cru Burgundy, because we've tasted these wines beside those levels and that hierarchy in Burgundy. And I'm not joking. They go toe to toe. I know everyone says it about their own wines, but
you know, I've seen it. I've experienced it firsthand. So obviously you're going to be biased on it. You should be. I've seen it myself. And it is like, you know, if you've listened to the podcast, I do talk a lot about pricing when it comes to Canadian wines. I think the main thing I want to get at is that almost like a public service. Hey, wine drinker, you want to love Burgundy. I do as well. Do you got $320 a bottle? You don't? Ah, sucks to be you. But for $100, which we acknowledge, that's a lot of money for a bottle of wine. That $100 bottle of wine, same yield as it does in France, handpicked. The vines might be 8-9 years younger, but they're still 20 plus 30 year old vines. So you're going to get almost everything you want, but at a third of the price. Does that interest you in trying Okanagan or something from Lincoln, Ontario?
Yeah. Where you look are that our counts are in Europe, they're at the best restaurants. And what do the restaurants care about? They want wines to pair with their amazing food, of course. They're more open to the idea of, we kind of don't care where it's from sometimes. We just want the best product, because it's the same when it comes to food.
Mm-hmm. But then you need storytellers. So the keys for, what's the famous wine store in London? Barry Brothers?
Barry Bros, yeah.
Barry Bros, thank you. If it's them, or if it's Michelin starred restaurants throughout the world, what's needed to help is the ambassadors, the champions. You need the storytellers to convince people, it's okay every now and then. Try the Okanagan. Trust me, you're going to like it. And you're going to have more money to get an Uber XL for the way home instead of an Uber share.
Yeah. Like we take from the airport.
Yeah.
I think what's also fun for us is, you know, Czech Meats Unique. We got this chess theme to our winery. Each wine has a move or a concept when it comes to chess that helps you orient what the wine is. Now, if we led in the project and just saying it's this vineyard from the Okanagan, many people might not just understand what that even means. But what you find with our wines is, like, people dial into the palate of Little Pond or the palate of Attack, and they find there's consistency. It comes from the same vineyards every year, so there's consistency there. And if you see that on the wine list and you know that you love Attack.
Can we pause this? Yeah, can we? We can pause it, yes. Ooh, that was emotional.
Just a bit.
So I don't know where I'm going to edit this back in. Now I'm going to get emotional. That was Brian Perry, the wine director for Ages and Ages of the National Club, who is basically semi-retired now and had a medical issue that we're all worried. We were told he is going to make a full recovery, and he just knocked on the door. And my first thought was, oh no, we're being too loud. Members are complaining. And we just got to see Brian. I was hoping to see him at the Checkmate event tonight. And he looks great. He sounds great. A couple of days ago, and I heard about it, we were all scared. And that was nice.
This guy has been one of the key figures, not only in my wine life, but just life period. I mean, when you think, when I was here at the National Club at that point in my life, I was a young dude.
Yeah.
And watching this guy, watching Brian every single day, the lifestyle, the charisma, the swag,
yep,
that you know he has, the stories, the history, the knowledge that he had, he was imperative for me in my life. And yeah, hearing the news a couple of weeks ago, especially being across the other side of the country, just broke my heart.
Yeah.
And not knowing how he was doing. So to see that makes you feel a whole lot better. And he's just an amazing guy. And I know he has been for you too. And your interview with him was dynamite. And it's great to see him.
Yeah, it's funny. We're both kind of, I mean, very different, but another similarity between us is, you know, I entered this club as, you know, one of the youngest members, and Brian treated me like, you know, like I was anyone else. And the same thing, you came here as a very young person, and he treated you like everyone else. And funny, in a lot of ways, you guys were both similar. You know, from that interview, Brian didn't know much about wine when he started here at the National Club. Hell, you probably knew more about wine than he did. But I mean, just that feeling when you start here of being a little bit overwhelmed.
I must have annoyed the shit out of a man. Like, I was the young geek that would just, you know, be reading textbooks between service and being down in the cellar with Ray and Brian while they were out there down there doing inventory or something. And I was just so thirsty and hungry for that knowledge. he's well seasoned at this point, so yeah, he's probably just like, shut up, kid. But it's like,
I don't care about Hudson versus Hyde Vineyard. They both make good Chardonnay.
Exactly. And he's always had that approach where he's like, he loves wine, right? So yeah, he knows what's good, he knows what isn't. But for me, yeah, I mean, you and I would sit up on 1874 and we talk about the pH of the soil and the acidity of the wine and all this stuff. And he would just look at me like just completely blank, like, what is this guy talking about?
By the way, I like to also use the word swag for Brian. I think that's a perfect way of putting it. Just like old school and swag. I've never done this before. I don't know. I don't remember what we were talking, but this could be such a weird edit, you know, like, oh no, it was about you and just, you know, your position there. And then about trying to get, you know, like old world people to be into these wines. Oh, and I think it was the last thing I was saying was about a lot of it is about storytelling.
Yes. Yeah. And you know, we're blessed. We've been making wine for 10 vintages now, or a decade of Checkmate Wine, which is really fun. We're going to do a big celebration this year to do so. But this Checkmate story really started over 40 years ago at this point. Anthony Von Mendel, our proprietor, you know, he's the pioneer of the Valley. He's the Robert Mondavi for the Okanagan. He really is. And he almost single-handedly has created this industry that's thriving in the Okanagan, despite a couple tough vintages, but we will persist, of course. He is responsible for so much development, investment, recognition of these wines. And the Checkmate story really started back then. He always had that vision for this Chardonnay exclusive house that would be making these premium expressions of the place. So it started ages ago. And, you know, compared to the history of the old world, of course, we're not there. We weren't making wine in medieval times, but we're starting to get to the point where there are stories to be told. You know, we name our vineyards after the families that farm them, that have been farming them for 50 years up until we got the vines, right? The Declavas and Combres. They had incredible vine material. Some made wine, some didn't. But to tell the stories of, you know, these immigrant families that came over and planted these crops, and we're preserving those vines, keeping them in the ground, and telling the story of this place, we're starting to gain that history and that storytelling, which is super important when you're putting a bottle of wine in front of someone.
We'll end it there. There's still stuff we could do. Save it for another time. By the way, I'm planning my birthday this year, end of May. I'm planning on coming back to Okanagan, and I've never seen Osoyoos, so I want to check out you guys in person and stuff. So I can't wait.
Yeah, and for anyone that is in the region, like, we Checkmate has become a destination, which is the coolest thing in the world. We don't call them tastings, we call them experiences for a reason, because mm-hmm. the moment you're driving up to the winery to the moment you leave, it's more than that, just a tasting. There's an experience, not just to the setting, the architecture, the building, the vineyards, but when it comes to the hospitality and what we've created there, it's just above and beyond anything I've ever experienced. And it's truly the most fun project to be a part of. And at the end of the day, you get to taste awesome wines like this. So it's worth the visit.
It's a great spot you're in. You're there working. You're going to be traveling. You're telling the story, whether it's in BC or whether it's all over the world. I love it, James. Like, honestly, I love watching your journey. I've seen it since when you were young. These are killer wines. You represent them well. You're a perfect person for this. You've been making wines in that area with your brother. So your story is about your passion, but it's also about family and so many other things. Before we end it, just tell people, where do they go? Websites? Where's the best place if they want to find out more?
Instagram, websites, Facebook, Checkmate Artisanal Winery. You'll be able to find us. The interesting thing about Checkmate, we make such little wine anyway that you're rarely going to be able to find it on the website or in many, many retailers. Give me a call anytime because I can direct you in the right direction. But we're getting to a point of very, very highly allocated wines that sell out in a day sometimes, like they did last year. Please give me a shout because I'd be happy to help you. And just before we sign off, I just want to say that I started this whole story with back in Ottawa. My brother and I would listen on the radio to TSN Radio, where a guy was talking about sports and wine, and that really introduced us to this cool world and kind of started a lot of that journey. So thank you, Matt, for starting that process.
I am touched. I'm honored. If I played 1% of 1% of 1% of your journey, that's fantastic. Thanks so much, my friend. Thanks for being on this.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on Spotify, Apple, and where quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.